it's Friday the 19th of June. I'm John Dennis. Today, Friday prayers in Iran and a test of the authority of the country's supreme leader.
Aside from these massive street protests that we've been seeing, there's a lot going on behind the scenes as well, with senior members of the regime talking to each other and trying to work out how to get out of this crisis.
More MPs in trouble after Parliament publishes edited details of politicians' expenses claims.
They're now committed to publishing these sorts of details every 3 months, but there are moves afoot to reopen the way they redact the material.
And we hear from Michael Bay, the director of this summer's blockbusting film Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen.
We all have a kid in us, and there's, again, the wish fulfillment.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the news headlines and a look at today's papers.
All 900 construction workers at the Lindsay Oil Refinery in Lincolnshire have been sacked. They walked out on strike last week in a dispute over redundancies, claiming the company Total had promised not to cut any jobs. Total says there are always redundancies as different parts of a project are completed. The Lindsay site was the centre of strikes earlier in the year over jobs being given to foreign workers. The sacked staff will all be allowed to reapply for their positions. Formula One motor racing may be broken up. The day before the British Grand Prix, 8 major teams, including Ferrari, McLaren, Red Bull and Braun, say they'll start a breakaway series. The head of Formula One, Max Mosley, has been trying to enforce a budget cap on teams of £40 million. But negotiations have broken down with the 8 members of the Formula One Teams Association. So the association says its members will set up their own series next year. One in 6 homes in England is in danger of flooding, according to the Environment Agency. It says more than 2 million homes are threatened by rivers and the sea. More than 2.5 million more are in danger of rainwater flooding from overflowing drains. And global warming, leading to rising sea levels, will only make the threat worse. The Salford Labour MP Hazel Blears has survived a constituency attempt to deselect her and stop her standing for Labour at the next election. She resigned as local government minister on the day before the local elections. She's apologised for the timing and handling of her resignation, which is accepted by a majority of her local party last night. MPs have now repaid nearly £500,000 in expenses claimed over the past 6 years. The parliamentary authority says 182 MPs from all parties have had to repay misclaimed cash. One is the Scunthorpe Labour MP Elliot Morley, who resigned from the government over expenses for a mortgage he didn't have. He's now had to pay back another £20,000 of money he claimed for a home loan. And it's back to MPs' expenses across the morning front pages, except there are a lot of words blacked out, which is how many of the documents released by Parliament actually look. Expenses, it's a blackout, is the Guardian headline, with a picture of black squares across Big Ben. It goes on, MPs accused of censorship as heavily edited claims published. Cameron, Osborne and Blair embarrassed over spending. The Times writes, freedom of information, shame of MPs after release of expenses. Officials black out many crucial details. And The Telegraph shows one such receipt from Gordon Brown across its front page, which only allows you to see his name, the date and the sum of £83. Next to it, it quotes the PM, transparency to the public is the foundation of properly policing the system. The Mirror calls the whole affair blackwash. The Sun calls them grasping MPs, blankers. And the Mail asks, just how stupid do they think we are? Claiming fury and disbelief. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
After a week of mass protests at which many have lost their lives, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, leads Friday prayers today with his authority at stake. Ian Black, our Middle East editor, says today's a critical point for the regime.
There's a lot of expectation about what Ayatollah Ali Khamenei will say when he addresses Friday prayers. This has been a very dramatic few days, obviously. There is a sense that aside from these massive street protests that we've been seeing, there's a lot going on behind the scenes as well, with senior members of the regime talking to each other and trying to work out how to get out of this crisis. So people will be watching very, very closely to see what the supreme leader has to say. Will he appeal for calm? Will he make any further concession to those who are protesting that the election result was stolen? It's a very important moment. It's always watched very closely in the Kremlin-logical sort of way that you sometimes have to interpret Iranian politics. It's a complicated and rather opaque place. But to have the supreme leader making a public appearance at prayers in the middle of a crisis like this is going to attract enormous attention.
And one of the people who will be watching very closely is the former president, Hashemi Rafsanjani. What's his role?
Rafsanjani is a very, very important figure behind the scenes. He dropped a real bombshell last week, a day or two before the election. And he issued a public statement calling on the supreme leader effectively to rein in Ahmadinejad. That's a pretty heavy thing to do in the context of the way the Iranian system worked. It was a public challenge, if you like, to the supreme leader. Now, Rafsanjani is powerful, but he's also very unpopular. He's widely seen to be corrupt. One of the electrifying moments in the election campaign was when Ahmadinejad, in one of those public television debates, attacked Rafsanjani and his family in particular for corruption. So there's a feeling that this is about, to some extent, is all about a battle of wills between Rafsanjani and the supreme leader for the outcome of this election. Some people even say that Rafsanjani may be able to engineer an outcome whereby another of these clerical bodies, the Assembly of Experts, actually impeaches Khamenei, the supreme leader. And that would be an extraordinary thing to do and without precedent. But the fact that those sort of stories are circulating gives a sense of the power struggle that's going on behind the scenes. We're only seeing the most visible part of this epic battle that's going on in Iran. We don't know much about what's going on behind closed doors.
Well, one person who hasn't been very visible is Ahmadinejad. What's happened to him?
Well, that's a very good question. He's not been seen for 3 or 4 days now. On Sunday, I watched him give his very combative press conference at his office in Tehran, where he notoriously compared the protesters to football fans whose team had lost. He then went on to a mass rally to talk to his own supporters in a square in Tehran. And then on Monday, he was in Russia attending a summit conference where he was greeted as the newly re-elected president of Iran by his Russian hosts. On Tuesday night, he was reported by the official Iranian media to have returned home and to have been greeted by senior government officials. And as far as I'm aware, he has not been seen or heard of since, which is intriguing, taking everything that's going on. You would have thought that if he was sure of his position, he would be out there fighting to bolster it. And in fact, the opposite is true. So he looks, by his absence, to be lacking in confidence, perhaps on the defensive, and uncertain of the outcome of these extraordinary events.
Ian Black, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Iran. Also on The Guardian's website today, Richard Williams' 20 Greatest Wimbledon Moments is at guardian.co.uk/tennis. The bikes, the robots, the dream of man and machine in perfect harmony. No, it's not Boris Johnson's transport policy. It's an extremely rare interview with Kraftwerk's Ralph Hutter. He talks to John Harris at guardian.co.uk/music. And there's the latest in the ongoing controversy about whether or not Kate Winslet is working class. That's at guardian.co.uk/lostinshowbiz. As I searched Parliament's website yesterday for the newly published details of my MP's expenses, I found more darkness than light. That was the experience of many people who found MP's receipts had been redacted or censored by parliamentary authorities. We did learn that Lib Dem Lembit Opik claimed £19.99 for a wig he wore at a charity event, and that Tory MP Graham Brady charged taxpayers £70.50 for a locksmith after he locked himself out of his home. But which home was it? Meanwhile, David Cameron said he would repay £947 he wrongly claimed on expenses. And Scotland Yard says that some MPs may face a criminal investigation. Andrew Sparrow was sifting through all that information and more with Guardian readers on our live blog.
The Telegraph had had this data for several weeks. They'd been publishing stories for more than a month. And the journalistic view had always been, well, actually, they've unearthed or all of the best scoops, there isn't going to be a lot left. But still, it was a really interesting moment because people could actually start doing the work themselves. And in the office, not just the journalists who were working on this with me, but pretty much everyone else was going to have a look, looking up their MP and finding things for themselves. And I think this really brought home the anger people feel about expenses in a way that the Telegraph stories, brilliant as they were in many ways, hadn't done, because people were engaged sort of firsthand in this.
And there was fresh anger about the way that the Parliament's authorities have censored this material yesterday. Was that sustainable?
No, it isn't. They're now committed to publishing these sorts of details every 3 months, but there are moves afoot to reopen the way they redact the material. You're right, because I'm looking at the pages, the first impression people had was just quite how little information there was. And I saw one of my favourites was a gas bill, in which every single thing apart from British Gas and the figure was redacted. And you can understand why people shouldn't be expected to give out their phone numbers or their credit card details, but there are ways. There's a question mark about addresses. Personally, I think MPs' addresses probably should be in the public domain, but you know, there was a case a few years ago where a Lib Dem MP got attacked in his surgery, one of his constituency staff got killed by someone, so there are legitimate concerns. But that doesn't mean you can't publish postcodes or sort of towns, or at least some details of where people live.
And there was another ministerial resignation, the junior Treasury Minister, Kitty Usher.
Yes, this was again a classic example of the way that the Telegraph were able to publish much more information about what MPs have been doing than we would have been able to if we'd just been reliant upon the information put out by the Commons authorities yesterday, because they got hold of a letter saying that she had basically flipped her second home for income tax purposes to avoid paying capital gains tax. She's a Treasury minister. The Treasury is there to try and get people to pay up tax to run public services. She clearly had a conversation with Gordon Brown at which it was agreed this was unsustainable. And she also announced, curiously, that she would be standing down as an MP at the next election. She said this was something that had always been in her mind anyway. She's got a young family. She's realised it's very difficult to combine life as an MP, let alone life as a minister, with a young family. But you do wonder whether, if she was still in government, whether she'd be quite so keen to give up a political career.
And in terms of what we did learn yesterday about the things that MPs have been claiming for on their expenses, was there one particular morsel that particularly you enjoyed yesterday?
It was the sort of trivia rather than the big things. And my favourite was when a colleague showed me an invoice for one penny submitted by Jeremy Hunt, the Shadow Culture Secretary, for a phone call. It was a mobile phone call that lasted 12 seconds. And you just wonder kind of quite what the point is. I mean, it wasn't a one penny item on an itemized bill. This was a whole single piece of paper, and to actually put this up must have cost more than one penny. That was one of my favorites. George Osborne sort of charging about 50 quid for a DVD of one of his speeches on the subject of taxpayer value for money. He says he constituents asked him for it. He wanted to give them a copy, although I must say I until yesterday I wasn't aware that MPs sort of handed out free DVDs of their speeches to constituents. Well, if they do, maybe I'll start sending off for copies.
Andrew Sparrow, and there's more at guardian.co.uk/politics. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, floods, droughts and soaring temperatures. The Met Office predicts how climate change will affect the UK.
It's aimed really at big organisations that are going to invest in infrastructure, facilities, planning, preparation.
But first, 4 years after the IRA's decision to dispose of its arms, loyalist paramilitary groups have begun decommissioning their weapons. The Ulster Volunteer Force has already decommissioned a significant number of its arms, and Henry MacDonald, our Ireland correspondent, explains why this is happening now.
Because the British government set down a very clear deadline. They said, if you don't do this by the end of August, we are going to send the PSNI after those weapons in those secret arms dumps. And I think as well, it's what the community wants. We have a political settlement involving unionism and nationalism, and the pressure has been on the loyalists to give up their guns. I also think within the loyalist movements themselves, within their leaderships, there is a feeling, you know, why do we want to hold on to the arms? You know, what's the point of having them now? They're only an obstacle to progress, and we have to give them up. It's what the community wants. They want paramilitarism to be allowed to wither on the vine.
Will other loyalist paramilitary groups follow suit?
Yes, I believe they will. The largest organisation is the Ulster Defence Association, and I think that they are in talks at the minute. I know they're in talks at the minute with the British government and General de Chastelain's International Decommissioning Body. This is the independent body which scrutinises the destruction of weapons and the putting of weapons beyond use. There's a rebel loyalist faction, and they spoke to me in The Observer about a fortnight ago. They're based in South East Antrim, the South East Antrim UDA Brigade. They are also in the process of negotiating the disposal of their armaments. So the three main loyalist factions are moving where the British government wants them to be, towards disarmament, but the UVF have now begun the process of actually putting the arms beyond use.
And what effect will this new round of decommissioning have on politics in Northern Ireland?
I think it'll just create a more benign atmosphere. You may have a situation where unionists might feel a bit more confident, for instance, about devolving the powers of policing and justice from Westminster to Belfast. I think you may have a more benign scenario for that to happen. The major unionist parties in power-sharing coalition with Sinn Féin and the SDLP are concerned about the rise of hard-line political unionism, as we saw in the European elections with Jim Allister and the traditional unionist voice. I think this development today, the Democratic Unionist Party, Peter Robinson, the First Minister, could argue, look, we've been engaging with these organisations for the last 6 months to a year, and we have now delivered. We've been able to persuade them to give up their guns, something which everyone in the community wants. So it strengthens the argument within that section of unionism. Look, as long as we're engaged in this political process, we can deliver tangible results, including the disarmament of all terrorist organisations in Northern Ireland.
Henry MacDonald. Average temperatures are likely to rise by more than 2 degrees Celsius across the UK by the year 2050. That's according to a major new report from Met Office scientists. They've produced a map showing how climate change will affect 600 locations in the UK over the next 100 years. David Adam, our environment correspondent, explains how it will be used.
Well, on one level, anyone can use it, anyone can access it. I've done this. You can literally type in your postcode and this tool will tell you the changes in temperature and rainfall in your own garden. If you're still around in 2080, you could test it out. But I think on a more serious level, it's aimed really at big organisations that are going to invest in infrastructure, facilities, planning, preparation over decades of timescale. So for example, a water company might be thinking of building a new reservoir, and if you're going to do that, if you're going to spend hundreds of millions of pounds, maybe even more, it helps to know how big you need to make it, and if you want to know that, maybe it would help to know how much the rainfall is going to change.
Now, launching this yesterday, the Environment Secretary Hilary Benn said that global warming would affect every aspect of our lives in the UK. How so?
Well, I think from a very basic level, if we think about how we behave differently from winter to summer, you know, we wear different clothes, we have different social lives, we have different behaviours and attitudes. And I think, so imagine it getting even hotter in the summer. Think how we all behave during the heat wave, for example. You know, think how hot the transport system was. Think how uncomfortable some of our offices were. Think how hard it was just to walk down the street to get an iced drink. And so on one level, there's that. And then there's all of the societal pressures, things like healthcare. Actually, climate change is not too bad for health, because although people are going to die of heat waves in the summer, many, many more people are going to be saved during the winter because they won't die of the cold. But there are issues like, you know, new infectious diseases. We might see malaria coming back. And then there's agriculture, how the different weather patterns are going to affect crops and the yields. And so on and so on.
And the scientists from the Met Office produced three scenarios of different climate change outcomes based on high, medium and low carbon emissions. Which one are we closest to?
They say that we're closer to the medium which surprised me actually, because usually when you talk about carbon emissions, we're right on the top of anyone's high scenario. So I suppose that it's good and bad news, but it also means that there's scope for things to go quite a lot worse.
And there's sort of widespread acceptance now that there will be some climate change, even if there's an agreement at Copenhagen in December.
Yeah, it's inevitable. Because of the way the climate system works, it's like we're wrapping a giant blanket around the Earth, and it just takes time for that heat to build up. But even if we were to cut carbon emissions to zero tomorrow, the blanket that we've been building up over the last 150 years, really, is still there. And so it takes maybe 30 or 40 years for the climate to reach that, what they call equilibrium. In other words, it just takes time for the lag to catch up with us.
David Adam. Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen. That's the summer blockbuster released in UK cinemas today. It's the follow-up to 2007's Transformers. It stars Megan Fox and Shia LaBeouf. Its executive producer is Steven Spielberg. And its director is Michael Bay, who spoke to Jason Solomons on our Film Weekly podcast.
We all have a kid in us, and there's, again, the wish fulfillment thing, and making people believe these robots are real. You know, it's I remember when I did the first one, people were amazed how realistic they were, and I got the comment over and over. It's like when I first time I saw Jurassic Park.
Yeah, and I was reminded of that. Your little robots, particularly, remind me of the little ones, the Prestige, the bigger ones in him, Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Is that a Spielberg? Because Spielberg, you work with him. Obviously.
Yeah, but it's not like he's. You mean he's not writing the scenes or anything like that? So,
but there's a sensibility.
Steven, what he's great at is inspiring me to. Like with Jurassic Park, he said, you know how many effect shots I had? I said, maybe 200. He goes, 56. Really 56. So when I do effects, there's some directors who will put 1,000, 2,000 effects into a movie when your movie's running like 3,500 shots, you know? Transformers 1, we had 400, maybe 500 effect shots where you put it on the screen. So it's more bang for the buck. And you can use more complex shots.
You're clearly a director who loves his shots, that loves the technique of movies. But what about, I wonder what about the message when I talk about futurism and stuff, what the actual sort of message that remains of the movie? Are you hopeful for humanity in that?
Absolutely hopeful for humanity. I mean, my movies almost all deal with heroism and sacrificing oneself for the greater good.
Yeah.
So if you look through all of them, that's what they're saying.
Because I felt that the first Transformers, maybe because it was going to lead on to the next one, there was a sort of a future of uncertainty. Machines were rising.
No, it's not. It's not dark like that. This is the first Transformers. To me, it was purely the charm of a kid hiding an alien robot in his backyard.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that earlier today we were talking, and you said that you weren't even sure after the first one that you would work again. The risk.
Well, I mean, I know I'm going to work
again.
It's just,
right.
It's just you put yourself out there when you're trying a movie like this.
Yeah.
That's not your staple of like a Spider-Man.
Yeah, no, I mean, but when you have the pressure of a Hollywood movie like this, such a vast amount of people, such a vast amount of money, such a vast amount of studio time and money, mm-hmm. is there an extra pressure? Do you already think, well,
it's absolutely,
you know what?
Pressure. I mean, people don't understand when you're spending $150 million and then you're marketing it for another $100 million, there's a lot of pressure. So it's like you're like a CEO running a huge operation.
Yeah.
You've got 2,000 people that are working under you, and you surround yourself with a great team. But, you know, I really, it's about leadership and how you guide your team, and you want everyone to be creative and add to it, and that's the fun of movies.
Yes.
Michael Bay talking to Jason Solomons. And don't forget, you can listen to all of our Film Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/audio. The producers of Guardian Daily today were Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.